Welcome back to Season 11 of the Neuroscience Meets Social and Emotional Learning podcast, where we connect the science-based evidence behind social and emotional learning and emotional intelligence training for improved well-being, achievement, productivity, and results using what I saw as the missing link, since we weren't taught this when we were growing up in school, the application of practical neuroscience. I'm Andrea Samadi, an author and an educator with a passion for learning, and launched this podcast 5 years ago with the goal of bringing all the leading experts together in one place to help us to apply this research in our daily lives. On today's episode, number 332, we meet Dr. Wallace and Dr. Artyom, the authors of the Wisest Learners book series. Dr. Artyom is an accomplished author and cognitive neuroscientist with extensive experience in the field. He earned his doctorate in cognitive neuroscience from the Max Planck Institute for Cognitive Human and Brain Sciences in Germany, and is now a researcher and a faculty member at LMU in Munich. Dr. Wallace is an experienced educator and entrepreneur with a PhD in educational psychology from the University of the Philippines, and he served as a headmaster, school administrator, for 14 years. He holds two master's degrees in entrepreneurship and educational leadership, and he's always looking at ways to further optimize the results of the students in his schools. Without further ado, let's meet the authors of The Wisest Learners and see how they connect the most current brain research to the future success of our next generation. Welcome, Dr. Wallace and Dr. Artyom. This is so exciting to finally get a chance to connect with you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us, and glad to be here today. Thank you.
Equally excited to be here with you.
Now, this is really cool because this doesn't always happen that we've got such a global reach here. Can you guys just tell me where I'm reaching you right now? Because this is fun. I didn't know where you all were.
So basically, I work at LMU. It's Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich in Germany. So I'm a postdoctoral researcher here and a faculty member.
Welcome. And I'm more of a digital nomad, so I travel to different countries almost every month. So this month, I'm in the Philippines.
Fun. And the weather right now, where you both are, because I think everyone knows I'm in Arizona and that the temperature is getting up into almost hitting 100 these days. But what's the weather like in Germany and Philippines right now?
So it's quite pleasant weather now. It's in 20s. So, but I speak in Celsius. I'm not sure how to convert to Fahrenheit, to be completely honest. Do you know what would it be? 22 degrees, 20 degrees Celsius?
I totally forget. I grew up in Toronto, so I should know Celsius. I just remember in the 30s, it was super hot, right? So.
Right, yes. Everything above 30 would be probably considered to be really hot, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to guess 70-something.
Yeah, it's pleasant. It's really good. It's an early spring weather.
Very nice. And how about in the Philippines?
It's very, very hot. Like 30s, like mid-30s or so. But very humid.
Humid too.
Well, so humid, so it's worse. So you really get a bit more sweaty than you.
That's what's cool about Arizona. It gets really hot, but it's a dry heat. So it's like nice. And when you're getting older and everything hurts in your body, you sit in the car. It's like going to a therapy session or something. It's fun. Well, welcome. This is really neat for me to have a chance to speak to people all over the world. And I don't take this lightly. Like this is a true honor to get a chance to meet with you. So welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to get right into, just before I get to the questions, I do want to know if you could give me a little bit more about your background. And I'm going to start with Dr. Artyom here. You know, where did your background begin to end up at wanting to write a book series that connects neuroscience to help our next generation? Where did this begin for you?
Right. So basically, I'm an experimental psychologist. I'm doing research in cognitive neuroscience. I did my PhD in Leipzig, in Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, a big place in Germany that is specifically dedicated to cognitive neuroscience research in humans. And so basically what I was doing is investigating cognitive control. So our executive functions, a human ability to suppress irrelevant information and pay attention to, you know, task relevant information. And not only that, I was only interested, also interested how emotions facilitate that process, right? So part of the brain, well, anterior cingulate cortex that is specifically designed for executive functions also has a part of it that is sensitive to emotions, to emotional content. And it seems that our executive control is, you know, naturally anatomically linked to affective information out there in the world, just because we have to control our actions while we're emotional and the other way around. So I was really interested in that. And later I've moved to Munich, to here to LMU, University in Munich. And I'm now continuing working with, you know, cognitive control and emotions. And I'm also interested in statistical learning, you know, how statistical regularities in environment around us facilitate our attention and facilitate our long-term memories. We use different, you know, techniques like EEG, electroencephalography, to study attention, to study working memory processes, long-term memory processes, as well as transcranial magnetic stimulation. I'm now in the VR lab. So it was the quietest place here to meet with you. We use fMRI. So all sort of different techniques to study these questions. Yeah. And how I'm a father of two, and my older son is now in third grade. And, you know, my adventure with the book and, you know, getting to know Dr. Wallace was my son struggling in school. Yeah, even now, right? So it's getting better. And it's a continuous journey of us parents and our kids. And so at some point, I was introduced to Dr. Wallace, who was a headmaster in school for almost 15 years. And I was seeking his advice on, you know, what should I do and how should I act in school and, you know, with my kids, with my son. And yeah, so that's when we started reading into scientific literature, because Dr. Wallace said, I mean, you know, you are the cognitive neuroscientist, you study brains, so you should know. And, you know, we started looking into different research articles on the topic. And at some point, Dr. Wallace said, well, you know, we've learned so far in the last year or so, why don't we systematize it somehow? Why don't we interpret whatever we've learned in, you know, a simpler language? And Dr. Wallace would share a lot of his stories, a lot of his, you know, practical experience, you know, being a teacher, being a school headmaster for so many years. And that is the, you know, how the book started, as a merge of cognitive neuroscience research and basic experimental psychology research merged with, you know, educational psychology and, you know, practical experience of Dr. Wallace.
Well, there's so much there I could ask a million questions, but I'm just going to ask, in your studies, did you study Jack Panksepp and his work with affective neuroscience and the emotions? Did you see him?
No, not really. Not
just curious. Well, also with two girls in the household, one took off and did well and the other struggled. And we as parents wondered what it is. And we have finally found a lot of the answers have to do with connecting the brain to learning. So just like you, like, you know, what can we do? And you reached out to Dr. Wallace for some answers. And we were the same here, wondering, you know, we have all this access to incredible information, yet one is still struggling. What can we do? So I understood and related to everything you said. So welcome. This is so exciting. Let's go to Dr. Wallace. Give us your background of, you know, you're working in the schools, in the trenches, and then how did you now connect neuroscience to education?
So on my end, I've been an educational administrator for close to 15 years, and my struggles then included when I would see students in school who wouldn't be performing as or reaching their full potential, And one of the things that I discovered was that oftentimes, because of the pressure of the government or our parents or even the school itself, you know, that we needed to cover so much in a particular school year, that we would like start off a school year, like jumping the gun and just like, go, 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 rush, 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 because we need to cover so much. We really don't have like a lot of time to wait. However, the problem was that we recognized that, oh, in doing that, we never really sat down and taught the students intentionally, deliberately, how to optimize their learning. It's almost like, okay, you want to reach point A and point B, but you just would just tell the driver, okay, just go there and don't use a map. You know, just go, just trust your gut feel and say, you know, and you'll get there one way or the other. But how much helpful it is to use Google Maps or like Waze, right? I just remembered when I spent my honeymoon in the US long time ago, we will use like these big maps. And then later on, it evolved to GPS, right? Remember GPS? And then now you have the phones, right? But I couldn't imagine like if we would go to the US, like non-US restaurant, and let's say there's no map, right? And you would just have to rely on, oh, you go to that highway, make sure you exit, like, right? It's hard, right? So in the same way, as a school administrator, it's like, I felt that there was really something lacking because it's so important for students to know how to learn optimally. And that was a big challenge because I couldn't find program or even a book that can be as comprehensive and as interconnected as I wished. And that's the reason why that set me on the journey of initially learning, taking a master's and then my PhD in educational psychology. And it was around then that I was able to talk to Dr. Artyom and we had these conversations. And obviously, like researchers, they don't really intend to like come up with results for practitioners to apply. It's like they have a different set of agenda, right? But at the same time, in going through the research studies, there's just so many journals that are just gems. And I would tell myself, oh, we need to get this out. And I would read another journal. Oh, we need to get this out. This one too, this one too, this one too. And then when Dr. Artyom like would then talk about it, like we need to like really come up with a book because so many educators, so many parents will benefit from this because a lot of these journals are so technical and a lot of these journals you need to pay for. You cannot just like get them for free. So we wanted to do, because we're passionate about it, wanted to do the heavy lifting for the parents and for the teachers. Like teachers are so busy, right? Like instead of attending trainings, you'd rather prepare lessons. You'd rather work with your kid. You know, parents are so busy living their lives, right? Working, and by the time they get home, so tired, right? But this is so important as well, like for parents to know how to help their kids, for educators to know how they can help their students. So we thought that, okay, this will be a very good way of helping these very important stakeholders, the parents and the teachers.
You know, when you were talking, you brought me back right to when I first moved to the US from Toronto, because navigating the streets, driving, I used a map back in 2001. There was no Garmins at the time, the GPS. And I would be driving and I would hit, like there was a dotted line and I would hit a mountain and the road wouldn't go. And I'd be like, now where do I go? It was so frustrating. So I was thinking, you know, just as you were explaining that back, you know, we started with having a map of how did we get from where we want to go, where we are to where we want to go. And then technology came in and made it easier. It would reroute me. to somewhere else. The Garmin would say, no, go this way. And I used to have it on my dashboard and program where I'm going to go, and I get there faster. But now, even better, I have it all the time on my phone. So I'm never lost. If I'm, you know, somewhere where I don't know, let's find another route or go even on another app and find another way. So when you were describing that, how are we going to get from where we are to where we want to go? It has improved over time. And now that you have found this connection, I am so excited, because as the educator, you would see how to do it. And, you know, Dr. Artyom would have the science. So it's amazing that you both met. How did you meet?
We have some common friends who introduced me to Dr. Wallace. And then I was complaining about my son's school situation and just was... It was quite difficult for a parent to see that, you know, your child struggles a lot, and then you try different things and they do not always work. And yeah, that's how we met online. And then Wallace visited me in Munich. So we stood here and worked together for over a month, you know, preparing our book. And then, you know, it's online communication. The world is so connected these days. And
definitely. Definitely. Well, I've got to tell you, if your child is in third grade, I remember how that felt. The leaps in where how their brain develops from third grade to 7 and 8 are huge. And I feel like everything started to connect as she got into 7th grade. Dr. Wallace, would you agree that just with a little bit more time, it's going to connect and the brain will start to learn much easier as it gets older? Do I have that right? That's just how it worked.
Dr. Arden can talk more about the brain, and I can talk more about the behavior.
Sure, got
like
it.
In school, for example, right? So, I would see a student when they shift from grade 6, so like this would be like around 12 years old, 13 years old. So that kind of shift, you will see interesting transitions. Like I would hear from parents say, what happened to my child? They completely transformed. This is not my child. Because it's like in the past, they would have like their children, let's say, being very sweet with them. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, suddenly like they will be asking questions, and they will just receive one word answers from their children. It's like, it's as if I lost my child to somebody else. Yeah, there can be different kinds of changes, but definitely there would be these life transitions. And I can imagine our parents also, our teachers also saw that when you were younger. Yeah, it just comes with it, right? It comes with the territory.
Definitely. Well, so how can we use these principles in your book, The Wisest Learners, to help our children not just excel academically, which is what we want as parents? We're, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm trying to not look at the grades and I'm thinking of the whole picture, their future. So how can we use these principles that you've created for their whole life?
I mean, I have a really long answer to this. So if you have enough patience. So when... You know, reading, going through these articles, we covered hundreds of articles. And in fact, in the book, we have short summary of all the articles that we've used for interested readers in the end of the book, in the end of chapters. We summarize what each research topic is speaking about, right? And then what we realized is that different researchers, different labs would be, you know, specializing in a specific aspect. Let's say, how critical thinking facilitates academic performance? Or is there a relationship between executive control and GPA? Yeah, so, and oftentimes there would be a positive association. But if we look at the variance, the amount of variance in your grades, or how much you like studying, or educational attainment, so amount of variance that is explained by these factors, let's say critical thinking, or executive control, or something else, it would never be 100%. And would it never be, you know, over 50%? So there would be a significant relationship, but it would be moderately significant or moderately strong, right? So it'd be like 0.3, 0.2 correlation, which is good, but is not the whole picture. So what became apparent to us is that there is not a single factor, a single principle that would explain the whole picture. So it's a collection of things that, I mean, make us humans, right? It's a complex, you know, psychological construct, right? So what we thought is, what we would like to do is to, you know, argue for a holistic approach, basically collecting these most important factors that we found in the literature that would be really important for education, for learning, yeah, for being able to implement these skills long term, and put it in a book, as Dr. Wallace was saying, explaining things in simple language. And one of the things that we advocate in the book is just to not, you know, first of all, of course, a holistic approach, you know, considering all these factors. But the second of all is trying to implement them or try to teach this principle as early on as possible in kids, so that we would achieve some sort of automaticity in their behavior. And automatic behavior is something that is really, really prominent in the brain that influences our behavior a lot. In our lab, we study automaticity by, you know, letting people learn certain associations between, you know, like some cues on the monitor and the target location. And what we find is, once such a behavior is formed, once you see a cue, your attention is automatically driven to that target on the monitor. And after a few hundreds of repetitions, it seems that it's quite difficult to relearn. So you get stuck with this, whatever you've learned before, and it's quite difficult to change, to relearn or learn a new association. So what happens in the brain is that brain kind of gets used to this automatic behavior, to these cues, to these rules in the environment, and it makes it kind of perfected in such a way that it doesn't need to involve as many brain areas anymore, right? Just to give you an example, let's imagine that we would like to, I ask my son, right? We learn a multiplication table now, you know, our evenings start with going over the multiplication table. And let's imagine I'm asking my son, let's multiply 5 times 20. Yeah. And if you are an experienced, you know, person in math, or like just you have, you know, basic math, you would not need in your mind to, you know, add 20 plus 20 plus 10, 20, 5 times. You would immediately answer 100, right? That's the answer. And what happens, you don't compute this information, but you pull it out from your long-term memory, just because you automatize the process so fast. So there is this Logan's theory of automaticity in neuroscience and, you know, experimental research that says that we bypass certain brain activation of certain brain areas, and we automatically grab the answer from the long-term memory. If we think of brain processes, for instance, we have such a brain area, IPS, intraparietal sulcus, and this area is located in the parietal region of the brain, so closer to the back of the head. And that area is particularly involved in computing different numbers, comparing magnitudes. And if you need to add, you know, 20 plus 20 plus 20 plus 20, you would need these brain area to be active. There is a different brain area called angular gyrus. And this brain area is kind of specializes in extracting facts, something that we know already, something that is common knowledge, something that we can immediately, you know, identify from long-term memory. So if we automatize something, let's say I'm asking my son to tell me what would be the, you know, the product of 5 and 20, it's only the angular gyrus mostly that would be active, just telling you answer immediately. However, if you're not efficient, you're not proficient in, you know, computing or multiplication, you need to do the, like, something following what would need to be done. So you would need your intraparietal sulcus to be active, because you would need to be actively computing. You would need your angular gyrus to be active, because you need to remember how to do multiplication. You need your frontal areas, like prefrontal cortex, active, because you need to shield your attention from being distracted while you're computing, right? And then you would need to also have your working memory, because you would need to store intermediate products or sums. 20 plus 20 is 40. And then you need to add 20 to this, it's now 60. So this everything in between you need to store in your working memory. So it's many more brain areas that are involved for a simple multiplication of 5 by 20, right? And just showing that being automatic with these processes is really efficient. And this, you know, example about multiplication is quite a simple one. But what we argue and what we show from the literature, that we can also automatize higher order functions. For instance, if you need to learn a new information, you do not always need to think, okay, let's remember what kind of methods or what kind of learning preference should I pick to learn better? Should I learn like once in 5 hours, or should I have 5 learning sessions, 1 hour each? Which one is better? You don't always need to go into a literature and try to remember what is the better approach from research, right? So it is the best if you automatize these processes, if they become your second nature. So whenever in your life it's necessary to learn something new, you would immediately implement, you know, your angular gyrus would light up if you were in the scanner, and it would just grab from long-term memory the best approach, the best skill for that particular learning situation, and you would learn. So our philosophy in the book is we offer this holistic approach. We offer all these principles, and we suggest that it's the best when kids or, you know, teenagers, whenever you happen to, you know, to start thinking about these questions, it's the best to automatize the process. And just it's done easiest if you start early on, and if you start with children, so that they grow, they go to school, and so these automatic, what we call the wisest learners approaches, grow with you.
When you were talking, it just brought me back to the first time I learned about that part of the brain. Is that not the same part that we use when we're learning to drive, right? Like automate that knowledge of learning to drive. In the beginning, we're like, what are we doing? And we're all nervous about it. And then eventually it becomes automatic. And even with sports, you learn a drill over and over again, and then you're performing, and it's that part of the brain that draws from the talent that you have that allows you to perform. Have I got that right?
You know, driving is a quite complex process. I would imagine that there are several, you know, factors, several skills you need to learn. You need to be able to drive and to be able to kind of know where to look or where not to look, where not to pay attention. So it's a multiple brain areas involved at the same time. But you're right, you would do it more efficiently once you are, you know, when you've been driving for 10 years now, and you do it without even thinking, which you shouldn't do, of course, when you're driving. But it often happens that sometimes you're doing it so efficiently that you do not even remember how did you get from point A to point B, just because it's such a second nature. But the important thing is that these same principles could be applied not only to doing sports or driving or riding a bike or, you know, typing on a keyboard, but also to higher order functions, like picking a learning strategy or metacognition or critical thinking. All these really important principles in education and learning could be automatized, could be become a second nature, could be used efficiently.
Got it. So now I got to bring it to Dr. Wallace. So how do we bring the joy of learning for our kids? Because we know what we want them to do, but how do we translate this to school?
There's several ways to go about it, but one of my favorite is, you know, I just want to highlight one, is autonomy. When we give our kids autonomy, we definitely give them joy. And obviously, the younger they are, you know, we tend to have a bit more space in terms of like us not giving them as much autonomy compared to when they're older, which is natural. But scaffolding that slowly, 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 giving them more autonomy will give them more joy. And it could be as simple as, you know, when they're younger, would you want to choose this color red or color blue? You know, it doesn't really matter, right? Or would you like to have a bigger one or smaller one? You know, then later on, it's like, oh, what would you like to do? Would you like to play football, baseball, or basketball? Would you like to read this book or that book, right? But giving them autonomy definitely gives them that kind of foundation where like, oh, I'm motivated. Oh, I'd like to do things. Oh, it reminded me of like when my daughter, so I have a 27-year-old and she's now in college. She just finished her graduate studies in Melbourne, so she's working now. But when she was like in preschool, one of the things that my wife and I decided to do was we want to encourage reading and writing. Okay, so what we did was we gave her this kind of autonomy where anytime you want that we go to a bookstore, unlimited. Obviously, it's not really unlimited, right? You cannot give unlimited. But you get the point, right? It's like you can get as much book you want, you know, writing journals. So what was amazing was to this day, she loves reading books, you know, like paperback. Like to this day, she loves to write because we gave her the kind of like freedom to like, yeah, it's like, you know, when it comes to books, you can have as much as you want, right? And giving her that kind of joy in reading. And it was like really fascinating that giving students that kind of autonomy can make such a huge difference. And unfortunately, the sad part is like, if you reverse that, where let's say parents or even school systems can be too controlling, right? Can be mandating, micromanaging everything, then that can easily kill the joy. So that's something that we have to be careful of. Yeah. So parenting, teaching is an art and science. So we have to know when to let go. We have to know the right way of letting go because it can make a huge difference in the lives of our children and students.
Beautifully said. I couldn't have said it better. It's everything you said rings true. And especially the giving them the choice. I've heard that strategy years when my children were young and I bought some sort of system to help them with, you know, behavior. And that was one of the main takeaways was to give them choice. Like, do you want to wear these pants or these pants when you're trying to get them dressed? And they're like, I'm not wearing any, you know, so it's to give them a choice. But there was no science to it. I don't think, you know, the neuroscience hadn't come out yet. So it's just amazing to see that these are strategies that we've been told to use, but probably the author didn't have the science to understand why. I think it's cool.
Right. So providing, like giving an opportunity to pick can create this feeling, right? So, I mean, when kids are small, both whatever they pick is safe, right? So it's different colors or different pens or different books, but it's everything that is good. But what it does, it lets kids learn to think for themselves, learn to evaluate information critically. And that was shown to have a strong influence on education and strong influence on learning beyond even just, you know, basic skills, just ability to think critically, to evaluate information in a critical manner seems to play a big role. And I think giving and providing autonomy, providing the opportunity to choose is something that fosters this, such critical thinking or belief in one's ability to choose for themselves.
And so this is your holistic approach then that helps for a parent to, you know, deliver this to our children or our students in the classroom so that they can overcome challenges, right? This is what you're saying. This approach that you're taking is the holistic way.
That is correct. So it's not a single strategy or a single learning principle, single pill that will, you know, or single product that you need to remove from your diet to be completely healthy. It's a whole ecosystem, or what we think are some of the most important principles that are important to consider for educational purposes. Yes.
And if I may add, like, it's like having multivitamins, right? You know, vitamin A is important, vitamin B is important, vitamin C is important, but you cannot just focus on one. It's so important to have all these multivitamins and to be able to consume them, to be able to get them as, whether from your vegetables, for supplements or drinks, or what have you, from the sun. But so important to get all of these in the right dosages, right? So in a similar manner, we cannot just say that, oh, it's only about motivation or it's only about mindset or it's only about like perseverance, but it's only about a strategy. Like all of these matter and being able to, one is to be aware, it's a starting point. Like, oh, okay, we need to have these, we need to know what these are and that all of these are actually interconnected, right? So what we believe in is important. How we think is important. All these things, how we process what we think is important. All these considerations matter. And it's not as, that's kind of like what we advocate all the time. Let's not get stuck up in just like in having a single solution, like a magic pill that will solve all of the world's problems.
Definitely. So in terms of practical application, so if I was to get the series and read it, how can you give me some tips on how to make sure that I'm applying the strategies so that my child learns it or in the classroom? So it's subtle, right? It's not, I guess every time I'm going to use a new strategy, I'll tell my kids, here, I'm going to test this out on you. And I'm openly telling them, but they roll their eyes and they're like, oh man, another thing. What are we doing now? It's goal setting. It's confidence building. I don't know, whatever it is. So how can we do this in a way that is not so open that they learn it and enjoy it and implement it?
I, to be completely honest, I really like your open approach. You come and say, that's what awaits you. And although your kids may be not showing a lot of enthusiasm, I think they also appreciate the fact that you're open with them. And that's a great way to do it, to be completely honest with you. In the book, for each chapter that we introduce different principles in different chapters. In the end, we also offer some practical tips. How can you start implementing whatever was in the chapter, step by step? For instance, in one of the chapters, we speak about the, role of parents in education. What we hear from many parents is that, my children are fat, they have clean clothes, they slept well, and now they go to school and it's now your job to teach them, right? So, and then if something is wrong, I would need to phone up the teacher or have a meeting with the teacher and, ask what's going on. You're not doing your job right. I have some, teacher friends, teacher relatives, and they also experience this a lot. However, from the empirical point of view, from the research point of view, it turns out that parental involvement is one of the most important ones in education. In the book, we discuss one article that contrasted three different types of involvements, three different types of ways that parents could interact with kids, with school, and whichever leads to a better educational outcomes, like GPA, and just feeling positive from going to school. So what they did, they looked at three ways. So one way was the way, how often the parents would be, checking students' homework, like a kid's homework, doing drills with them, extra exercises, learning the multiplication table, what I'm doing now, teaching the multiplication table and checking if kids understand. That was one type of involvement. The second type was more school-based involvement. How often the parents would go to school, talk to teachers, participate in school-based events, some, fundraising, volunteering for school, being in school, being present in school. That's the second type. And the third type was so-called home-based involvement, where there is nothing being done for, in terms of education. So you're not trying to teach anything. You're not trying to check if
academic. Are you referring to academic socialization?
It's academic socialization. That is correct. Thank you so much for correcting. So it's academic socialization. So what it means when parents would spend some time speaking about the importance of school, why what you learn now is important for your future career. Why is, you know, the photosynthesis that you learn is so good to know what happens in the leaves, right? And, you know, how is the sun involved? And just speaking about the importance of education. And when I was reading the article and what I was reading the introduction, I thought definitely the home-based involvement, when you do the drills, when you, you know, train your child, when you, you know, spend time with your child doing things that will be tested on later on in school, should definitely be one of the greatest factors that would contribute to their grades. In fact, it turned out to be least important ones. And if you only implement this one type of involvement, you know, doing drills, the home-based involvement, there was even a detrimental effect on education. There was a negative association with grades. On the other hand, if you have the academic socialization, when you speak about the importance of school, coupled with the school-based involvement, when you show your child that the school is as important as, you know, for adults to go there and spend their time there, you know, a combination of these two produce the strongest, the most positive effect. Yeah. Which is not to say that, you know, the home-based involvement does not play any role. So it has its own part in it, right? In this holistic view on the education. So you need to check, you know, spend time helping your child with homework. And I mean, there are debates how much you should be involved, but it still needs to be done, but that's not the most important part, right? So it's not most important piece of, you know, parental involvement. And in the book, we speak about this. We speak about some other studies that how they showed this is basically the same thing on a larger samples of, you know, participants. And we also offer a few steps. How do you spend? So do you get involved in school activities? You speak about with your child about the importance of education, because we show the statistics, right? So parents spend about 1.5 to 2 hours a day with their kids aged 8 and above. So they're either in kindergarten or school, and then you see them in the evening and in the morning, and that's it. So most of the time they spend in school, and it is really important that you tell, like you share how much you value education, how much it will be important later on in life. So this motivation to learn, this understanding of the importance of school will be following them throughout the day while doing drills and, you know, reading extra 15, you know, minutes or doing extra, you know, round of math problems will have a short-term effect. And at some point can even introduce some sort of an aversion. Right. So kids would be not willing to do it because they are forced to, or because they have some negative feelings associated with this. So, yeah. So we offer quite a lot, I would say, practical tips as well on how parents can, you know, start implementing these principles right away after they finish reading the chapter.
And Dr. Wallace, what would you say as well to that? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so to build on what Dr. Archimedes shared, one of the reasons that it's very important to share this with the children, with the students, is that because they will know the value of what they're doing. So that creates, and we discussed in the especially in the teacher edition, task value, like knowing the value of their particular task or activity, as compared with when Dr. Artem shared about the home-based involvement where parents get involved and sometimes can be detrimental. And I've seen this in school, sometimes preschool kids and families where like a teacher will give a fun activity at home and okay, draw something. And the parents will be the one to draw the house or draw the animal. Yeah, so it's like wanting to make it the perfect piece, but then the point is for the child to learn it. So then it creates that sense of dependency. So that's why I say these are all connected, because what happens with the first one, academic socialization, we build that task, we establish the task value. So now the child on their own, the children on their own will now appreciate schooling. So now they go to school very excited because, okay, this is important. This is something that can impact my life for whatever reason. I can make friends. I can learn a new skill. I can now do this. Or however the parents have framed it. on the other hand, sometimes when like what happens is like if the home based involvement becomes excessive, then now like the child goes home and say, oh, I won't study first. I just have to wait for my dad, my mom. And then, okay, they can help me understand. So now the effort of learning is now reliant on another person. And that, can you imagine that if that becomes a mindset, if that becomes something that's permanent or something that becomes a habit, like, so it's going to take a long while to get out of it, right? It becomes like a rut. So that's also the reason why in the book, we started it off with what we call the parental engagement cycle. And to what you shared a while ago, and when you share something with your children, there's also something that beyond just explaining, just talking about your children, we call it, you know, in simple terms, modeling, when you don't necessarily have to say anything and you model it to your child, right? So what happens is like when you encounter something that might be less comfortable, let's say you wanted to learn something about a new, let's say a device, a new phone, like, or a new, maybe a new equipment at home, a new appliance. Then it's like, how do you respond to it? If you respond to it in a way that makes like, oh, I'm not really a techie person. I have to wait for dad, or I have to wait for my brother. I have to wait for, then that conveys something, right? Even without saying anything, it's just like when you like just, oh, get frustrated and not say anything and ruins your day. Our children, they'll see that, right? So all these things, the way we model, we have to be very, very careful. That's kind of like the most, it's both the easiest and the most difficult because we're not really saying anything. We don't have to think of words, and but it's most difficult because it's really us in our most vulnerable, most authentic selves, right? So we have, and that's kind of like the starting point with when we conduct like parenting workshops. So we go around different countries and conduct this workshop, and that's one of the first things that I will like emphasize. I'd like you to be aware that you'll need to be good role models because whether you like it or not, you're modeling. And your children will see, and someday they'll go back to you and ask you, how come you're saying this, but you're doing that? So, I mean, like, we have a whole chapter about it, but modeling is really like the starting point in our framework called parental engagement cycle.
I love it. I love that. And you know, they're watching all the time. And, you know, when you were talking, Dr. RTM, about, you know, how much do you come in and help? It's been over the years, I come in and I help and then I pull back because I don't want to have them reliant on me helping. But I didn't realize what I was doing. I was just like, I don't want to give too much. So I'll sit and I'll do some work and then I'll watch the grades and see how the grades doing. And am I needed? Am I not? It's like it is an art and a science of coming in and supporting and pulling back so that they can do this on their own, right? I want to build a reliant child in the future, not, you know, reliant on me, because one day I know I won't be there for the decisions they need to make. And so this is powerful work that you both are doing together. I'm thrilled that you've created this. This is incredible work. And I've just got to ask, I know I could keep going. We're getting close to the top of the hour, but I've got two girls that are, they do competitive gymnastics. So I'm just wondering, you've got a forthcoming book coming. What tip can you give us on building, you know, building that sports side of a child, the athletic side? What would you suggest?
Okay, I can start with that. So in getting through the athletic aspect, I know that it's such a big thing in the US, right? Like, you know, the soccer moms. And in fact, in our upcoming book, we tap two coaches. One's like a professional basketball coach, and the other one's like a former player who's also coaching in a youth league. And in writing, co-writing this book, we hope to be able to pretty much use the same principles to be able to reach out and share with parents and their children, hopefully to be influenced positively. One thing that came out during our discussion also, which will be coming out of the book as well, is that parents have to make sure that children are having fun. Okay, it's very basic, but sometimes because parents can be so competitive, right? Like mamba mentality. So I was like this is like the next Michael Phelps, for example. Like, you know, having the kind of like expectation and putting that on the child, right? And it's like, but at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, your 7-year-old child, your 8-year-old child, you know, like they just want to play. But some parents can be like so gung-ho about like wanting to, no. We have to like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, every step, every hour of the day, we need to do something because like you're going to be the next Tiger Woods, right? So it's like, and I've seen this in school as well, where like, because of that kind of mentality, like many children actually, many students got burned out and they totally wanted to just stop playing the sport, and they lost their love and fun and joy, you know, playing that sport. So I'd like to encourage our parents, like, yeah, okay, don't forget that basic foundation of like, we want the children to have fun when they do this, right? And that's something that in practical terms would mean that sometimes you have to like, okay, you have to pause, right? Sometimes it's like, okay, yes, they continue, but you have to talk to them, right? There has to be that constant conversation. And there will be times where like, okay, we need to do something else. So again, it's an art and science. Every child's different. You know, the context of every family is different. But going back to the basic of like, try to find that joy, try to find that fun aspect, and the child should never lose sight of it.
Trying to do that all the time. And it's funny because the girls come to me and they tell me what's happening with their friends. They'll say, you know, whether it's school or sports, if they don't get a high score in sports, their parents are punishing them. Or same thing with school, they're getting punished for grades. And I'm just shocked because I think, you know, how is that going to motivate, you know? But is there any sense to punishing kids? Where does this come from? Punishing them for not getting a good grade or score. Where did that ever start?
Yeah, if you think of something that motivates you to learn, right? Be it fear because you'll be punished, or be it joy of learning just because you really enjoy it. Short term, that would be equally efficient. Yeah, so you would be spending your time reading the book, preparing for the test. And, you know, you'll get it done in both ways. The problem is that if you're punishing your child for, let's say, bad grades or, you know, failing a test, what happens is that you put your attitude towards your child, so your love towards your child, independent to grades or independent to a teacher's opinion, whatever teacher is, you know, telling you about your child, and your, you know, attitude changes immediately. So that creates a, you know, really big barriers between you and a child, and long term it will heat back, it will backfire, and it's not a good idea to punish your kids for not doing well in sports. And you know, punishment could be different types. You can remove pleasant activities, that would be a punishment, right? You could be, you know, being mad at your child, and this negative attitude is a punishment. So yeah, short term definitely it would work, but long term it will, you know, evolve into a test anxiety, because you'd be afraid to fail, you'd be afraid to experience this negative attitude again. But the problem is that when you have test anxiety, for instance, right, that happens quite often. I would say, I think from statistics, what we've described is about 30% of students have some sort of signs of a serious test anxiety, different types of their, you know, school or college that most frequently happens in, you know, transition from middle school, from elementary school to middle school, from middle school to high school. So this time when there are lots of tests. So what happens is that when you experience test anxiety, this anxious situation blocks your thinking process. You are so alert. You're kind of placed in a survival mode that you cannot reach to angular gyres. You cannot extract facts anymore because you feel frozen. You cannot think of it. And, you know, oftentimes these kids would say, you know, 15 minutes after the test, I could immediately remember what was the correct answer. But at the the information is in your head. It's in your long-term memory. You've studied well and it's there, but you cannot just extract it in the right moment. And, you know, if the reason for that is because you have a parent who is overreacting, doesn't really help in the long term. You're making it just worse. So I would not advise to punish kids for bad grades and, you know, spend more time on, you know, home-based socialization or academic socialization and get more involved. Model, you know, learning activities. Learn something yourself. Show, you know, how you deal with challenges, how you have to learn something new. That's the best approach.
If I may add, parental conversations with their children, they're so important, right? I had shared this story before, and probably I'd like Artem to be the one to share it. Remember Artem, you talked to your son about tests?
Exactly. So I was my son is now in the third grade, and in Germany, some mid-second grade, they start having like simple tests, and then at some point, the test would be graded. So what we are trying to learning from the book, learning from what we've, you know, learned in the articles and in research, was trying to convey that tests are important, but the tests are just a signal. So they show what's your current state of knowledge. It's like a charge on your phone. You know, if the phone is not really charged, or if you have 10% left, it doesn't mean that you have a bad phone, right? It's just not charged. Or if you have 100% of charge, it doesn't mean that you have a better phone. It's just, you know, a charged phone. It doesn't evaluate, like the charge itself does not evaluate the quality of the smartphone you have. The same with tests. They just highlight what's your current state of knowledge. The tests show, okay, you're doing really great in this area, you know, these questions, but these ones are, you need to spend more time learning about those. And so I'm trying to, you know, long-term avoid the possibility that we have any sort of a test anxiety later on. And so this is something that, as you said, I would say openly, and I would explain that, okay, let's speak about tests. What are they for? What to look out for? And why they are important. They define, you know, your, you know, future opportunities. Specifically in Germany, you know, after the fourth grade, there is, depending on your grades, you can either go to a gymnasium, so like a school, you know, type of school that lets you go in further study at university, or you go to a different school that will not you so easily go and study at university, right? You would have to have extra effort needs to be done. So early on, already after the fourth grade, your almost fate, so to say, is decided, right? And tests play a big role here because they basically define your grades and explain what is your future.
Yeah. And what was remarkable was when Artem ended that conversation with his son by saying that whatever the results of the test, they do not define my love for you.
Ah, love it. Love it. Yep. I tell my girls that all the time. I stop looking at their grades because it doesn't matter, that this is one aspect of life. And I, you know, they're like, did you see? And then one time I missed that my oldest had a poor grade because I would look and maybe have a conversation if I noticed they're slipping, but I missed a poor grade once. And she worried for so long that I was going to, that something would happen because of the poor grade. It was like years later, she's saying, you didn't see it. And I'm like, because it doesn't matter to me what the grade is. That's not what matters. What matters is your day-to-day happiness. I love it. Awesome. Awesome work, you guys. I just, at this point, have I missed anything in the questions for you?
No, I think the book is quite you know, we have a lot of things to say and a lot of research to tell about. So maybe if it's interesting for the parents, we would welcome everyone to get the book and to read the book. We have a web page, wisestlearners.com, where people could learn more about the books that we have. And we have some blog post articles for everyone who's interested. You could go and check it out. And the book is also available at Amazon. So just search for Wisest Learners. Yeah.
Wonderful. And we will have different editions for, you know, we already have our for parents and for teachers. And we will soon have for test takers, for parents of those whose kids are in athletics. We will even have like children's story, because, you know, there are certain things that we want children to learn in a storytelling manner. Yeah. So it's really like a portfolio or an array of modalities and additions.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining me today, you know, all the way from Germany and Philippines. I just want to thank you for your time. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. I've missed talking to people about learning, but most importantly, it's learning about the brain and how can we help our next generations. And you both have created something that will do that. So for anyone listening, go to wisestlearners.com and get the book, because this will change your life as a parent and a teacher, I know, because we sit there and we wonder, what else can we do? Well, it's understanding how the science can influence your child. So I want to thank you both so much for this.
Thank you so much once again. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It's really a great opportunity to be speaking with you and sharing lives with your listeners and audience.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much.